And I'm really, really pleased to be joined on the line by my next guest, who I've admired for a long time. And it's Tadhg Hickey, who is a comedian and author. And how are you, Tadhg?
Orla, I'm very good. I'm very, very good. How are you, Garth?
I'm not too bad. It's a real pleasure to be chatting with you. And I've so much to talk to you about because I've been following your career for a while. And you've had a very, very busy year. So maybe we'll start off by, before we get to the upcoming performance in The Everyman, tell us a little bit about becoming an author. How long has that been, you know, in your sort of psyche that you're thinking about, I'm gonna write a book?
Like, it wasn't really something that I was mad to do. It kind of came from, like, I did a play about my alcoholism. Well, I say about my alcoholism, it was kind of loosely based on my own story, and it was a piece of fiction. It was called In One Eye Out the Other, and it was very surreal. And I always thought that that was going to be my alcoholism story, if at all. If I was going to go there, I would go there in a surreal kind of way and let that be that. Mm-hmm. The beauty of the surreal thing is that, you know, you can kind of hide a little bit in the stories. You know, you can hide in the kind of phantasmagorical world and kind of go, that's like 5% true, and that's enough for me to kind of put out there. But yeah, the publishers, Bonnier, just approached me and said, you know, would you think of doing the real story at all? And initially I was like, geez, I don't know, because, you know, you're talking about family and I'm comfortable talking about my own story, but I don't want to be getting anyone else into trouble, or, you know, so like I had to change all the names and kind of some of the drinking stories and whatnot. But anyway, basically I went on a bit of a journey in my head, and I'm not making myself out to be a great guy, but I thought that if I wrote the real story, it might help one or two people that might be thinking about trying recovery, and they wouldn't know kind of how to or where to go or whatever, you know. So I thought if they had followed my stuff and if I put my story out there, that it might kind of help a couple of people or whatever. So that's where it came
that's
from, really.
It
wasn't
from.
Like a burning lifelong desire, really, to be
how
fair.
Interesting. Yeah, that is interesting, because, you know, I did see your performance, and, you know, it was incredible. And the thing is, like, having to move from that sort of surreal performance, as you describe it, to then suddenly being, you know, bearing your soul, it must have been a difficult transition from one to the other? Or once you started down the route of telling the real story, was it easy for you? Which one was more cathartic is what I'm trying to ask you.
Yeah, geez, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I wonder, yeah, I mean, maybe they were just cathartic in different ways. So, like, the play, I didn't even realise that I was putting some of my own story in there until other people would say, oh, that's a bit like your mam there, or that's a bit like the thing you've told me about the way you felt when you were a kid, or, you know, because, like, you know, if you, as you say, like, if with the play, there's, you know, he's friends with the turkey, and there's a Sonny O'Sullivan cardboard cutout in the attic that he kind of becomes enamored with. And so it's all mad stuff. But then people who know me would say, oh, that's a bit like this, or that's a bit like that. So there was moments in the play where, like, there's a scene at the end where his mam reappears to him. The character's called Fergal. And, you know, like, I ended up kind of getting emotional because I was like, oh, right, that's, I'm obviously trying to write some sort of a what would you say, coming together with the mother, or reconciliation with the mother.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realise that. So then the book is the exact opposite, because you're kind of supposed to go there on every page.
For sure.
So I found it harder to get really brutally, brutally honest. I think that's probably the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. And then once I felt like I was brutally honest, it kind of just flowed out of me then, to be honest. Like, it didn't actually take a mad amount of time to write. But the hardest thing is to just be totally honest with yourself. Like, and by that I mean motivations, feelings, like, why really were you doing things? Or, you know, because I think it would be easy to write some things that I did, and then in my drinking story, and kind of go, ah, well, it was just a drink, you know, because that's not true either. Like, there were times where I knew if I started drinking, I wouldn't be able to stop. But I still always had a choice, really, when I was about to start drinking. So that was, you know, that type of honesty was hard to kind of get to, like, but once I did, it was kind of fine then.
And how long are you sober now? How long have you, you know, been off the drink as such?
8.5 years.
Wow.
I've been not drinking, yeah, but hopefully, as the book kind of points out, like, that's only the beginning of the healing then, because you have to deal with the kind of insanity that underpins all the mad drinking to begin with, you know, all the anxiety and all that kind of stuff. So sober is a funny word. I think the Americans use sober quite literally, you know, so they say, like, I'm sober 20 years, and it would mean that they've stopped drinking 20 years. But I think in Ireland we're a little bit more sensible, and sober for me would be maybe about 2 or 3 years. I'd be like continually sane and productive and not mental and not as self-obsessed as I was. That's how I would kind of... That's my metric anyway.
And that's so interesting because, you know, when you do, I feel that I can relate to, you know, hiding feelings under alcohol and, not, you know, just, you know, on your night out, you're drinking a bottle of wine and everything is funny and jokey and everything, you know, I haven't had to go to the next level. But even just sort of when you're out with friends and you're having a couple of drinks, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, sure, look, I'm having a bad day or blah, blah, blah. But it's only when you're alone with your feelings and maybe you are not, you know, having a cup of tea at the kitchen table. That's the hard part when you're realizing, why was I having a bottle of wine every night and how can I face those problems? And you talk about that in your book and that can be very helpful for people who are thinking of maybe facing those fears as well.
Exactly. Like what you described there is just you're on a certain part of the scale and I just went way further into it. You know, I'm just further along. That's a really good way of putting it because then it kind of normalizes a little bit in a good way the character of the addict. They've just pushed things kind of a lot further because maybe they needed to. So I think most Irish people drink on their feelings. Like there's nothing unique about alcoholics. You know, that's how we're taught to drink really, or that's how we grew up with it. It's just that like when you keep pushing it and you keep blocking out the feelings, I kind of had the kind of sensation that they're just being stored and then they kind of explode on you. And that if that marries with the moment where the drink isn't kind of taking the pain away anymore or isn't kind of solving the feelings problem, then you have this kind of great symphony of torturous kind of energy all over yourself, like, and there's no anesthetic left to kind of take it away.
No.
So I suppose like one thing I've definitely learned in recovery is like you don't have to be sitting on the street drinking a bottle out of a paper bag, or you don't have to have a really extreme heroin problem to recognize that, you know, you're using or drinking on your feelings and you can stop like much earlier. You know, that's something that I didn't really get for a long time in recovery. Like you don't have to go all the way. Like for me, I definitely got to what I would call rock bottom in my mind. Like, you know, I couldn't kind of handle things in my mind anymore. But I think the whole point of recovery these days is that like is to try and catch people as they're on their way to the bottom, you know. So
And
it's also not trying to scare people.
No.
Like, you know, like hopefully people will identify with the feelings, as you said, even if they're not alcoholics or even if they don't have mental health problems, they'll just identify with the feelings of being like a scared little child, which is basically what I was before I started drinking, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, the book has done extremely well. And how surreal must it be? You know, I've walked past Easton's a couple of times and there's rows and rows of your book. When you're walking when you're walking past and you see your face loads of times on a shelf, how does that feel?
It's actually funny you say that now because my daughter, I have a 19-year-old daughter who's a big part of the book, and she sent me a couple of videos yesterday where she was walking around town and she took a little video of like opening the front cover of my book and pointing out the place where I'd signed it, you know, because you do these kind of pre-signings to try and get people to buy it because it's signed by the author, and she was just commenting on how atrocious my writing was. But it's mostly lovely, to be honest. It's just like it's one of the few projects I've done where I don't have that kind of feeling of, okay, what's the next thing? And, oh, is it doing as well as I hoped it would do? And because I think if you have the kind of insecurity and childhood that people like me have, you're always looking for kind of approval. So sometimes it's hard to enjoy something. You're just like, oh, where's the next thing? Or where's the next thing? So that more people can tell me I'm a good lad and I can feel okay in myself. That's not there at all with this, which is such a relief. It's just like, you know, I was asked to do something. I feel I've done it as best I can. It's out in the world and a few people are getting on to me to say that they're getting something out of it. Like, so it's kind of job done. Like, I'm not really hanging on to it that much in
that's,
a good way. Yeah.
That's such a good explanation of it, to be fair. And, you know, it's a great read. I've read it. It's a great book and it's a lovely Christmas present as well now, Tig. We'll get
it's
that in there.
It's an ideal stocking filler, Orla.
Perfect. That box is ticked. But like, is you've done that now, but is being on stage sort of your first love? Would that be something that you really enjoy? I'm always interested in the process of people before they go on stage. How do you feel? Like, are you in the horrors? Do you feel euphoric? When you go on and you do your set on stage, how do you feel before that?
I tell you now, right, which is going to be a weird thing to say in a conversation that's ultimately promoting a live gig. But the live thing would not be my favourite,
right.
I have to say.
How interesting.
Yeah, so I love chatting to people, mm-hmm. and I love meeting people afterwards and having conversations and stuff like that, especially if we kind of go down rabbit holes politically, or, you know, mm-hmm. you meet people in the UK that would have angles and stuff that I hadn't thought of before now in mm-hmm. Scotland or Wales, and I love all that. But getting up and performing live, it's something that I've had to learn how to enjoy.
Yeah.
Because I used to be so up in my head, like I ended up doing a lot of CBT, which really helped with the anxiety mm-hmm. Before I go up there. But even now, though, it's a kind of a nice, comfortable feeling, and it's when it's going well. But I don't thrive off it. I'm not one of those performers that, like, oh, when I hear the laughter and the energy of the crowd, you know, that really makes me feel whole. It's not that at all. I'm more interested in making work, I suppose, like of all different types and whatnot. So whether that's live or it's plays or books or music, I'm just more interested in kind of making work than necessarily the live thing. But I would say my first love actually is and was music.
Really? How interesting.
Yeah.
And do you sing? I didn't know that about you now.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. Yeah. Tell us about that.
I used to be in a band called Exit Pursued by a Bear in Cork many moons ago. We were kind of an alternative electronic mm-hmm. kind of act, and we got some good reviews for our albums, but we didn't become a commercial success, sadly. But that would be the thing I'd often kind of go, oh, that was great crack. Like, there's something, because I think this is getting very kind of pseudo-intellectual.
But
philosophically, I think the music is a real, like, the crowd and the musicians are collectively enjoying something together.
Yeah.
You know, so like we used to do gigs where there'd be people dancing, like there could be 200 people dancing, and that collective experience I really got a great buzz off. Whereas I think comedy a little bit is like man or woman kind of shouting jokes at audience who
yes.
laugh at jokes. Like it's much more transactional, I think, than communal.
Yeah, because it's joyful.
So, yeah.
It's joyful, isn't it? Like when if you go to a gig and you're dancing, it's almost the energy from the movement and enjoying the music. It's a collective thing that everybody.
Yeah.
So the musicians are performing the music. You're enjoying the music, and you're then sort of paying back to them by dancing or singing along. And it's sort of like, you know, everybody in the room is having the fun.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I used to love. I think there was just something very spiritual about it that I used to love. No, I was also taking a lot of drugs and drinking at the time.
Yeah, of course.
Part of it. But no, that's definitely my first love.
Yeah.
And like before I get completely and utterly into this midlife crisis that I'm obviously already mm-hmm. in, mm-hmm. I would like to do more music or art and stuff. So yeah, I'm keeping my kind of eyes peeled for that.
Well, I wish you well in that endeavour, because there's something fantastic about being able to make music, and I'm in awe of people who can do that. But so you are coming back though to do the shouting jokes at people on the stage, and it's going to be on the 4th of November in the Everyman. Now, you're not alone. You do have yep. Cornelius Patrick O'Sullivan, who is hilarious. If anybody goes to the Roundy, you'll see him there.
He's
very, very funny. He's a very funny guy. And of course, you have Mario Rosenstock. Never heard of him. But I'm only joking.
He's a good kid. He's breaking through at the moment. I think everyone
yeah.
should support him. I see a bright future for that guy.
Yeah, I think you could be right. But how do you feel to be on stage with those three? I mean, I know they're very different. Everybody's very different styles.
Yeah.
But It's such a great combination, though. If you're going out for a night out, you're going to get a great night out.
I think it's like, for me now personally, if I could hand pick people I was gigging with, I nearly would have picked them, because Con is, you know, Con's one of my best buddies.
He's
but
he's very
also
funny.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And he was with me for a lot of my tour as well. He was with me in Dublin and Cork, so we gig together a lot, and I obviously gig in the Roundy a lot and stuff.
Yeah.
I kind of made my set over the course of the year. But Mario, aside from being obviously an absolute colossus and legend of Irish comedy, is also just super, super sound. Like I'd love to just kind of like, I wish people knew how sound he was, you know, because he's like right from the outset, years ago, like when we were trying to do stuff with Cahoots, he was always like really supportive of myself and Laura. And, you know, he had us on his radio show when we kind of weren't on anything else, really, you know. And
yeah.
I know that he's like that with other people. He's one of these successful people that's not looking over his shoulder.
That's maybe putting the ladder down for other people to climb up.
Big
and,
time.
Mm-hmm.
Big
That's
time,
really
yeah, yeah. And I love
yeah.
that about him. And he's also, like, you know, he's a sensational impressionist, but his kind of off... I'm always telling him that he should do, like, stand-up as well, though, because he's, like, his off-the-cuff stuff is just so funny as well.
And he's a very interesting person. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen him chatting as himself. He's actually very got a very interesting story to his life as well, you know. But I think when
he's really deep, like
he is. And when you're doing these impressions, people can think, well, that's all that there is to you. But in fact, it's not, you know.
Exactly. He's talked actually about doing promo for gigs where, you know, like he'll come on the radio and there's he thought it was a chit chat like this, you know, like just informal, having a bit of fun. And then they'll say, like, well, Michael D, how are you getting on? He's straight into the impression, you know.
My
goodness. So look, that's the business we're in, like, but I just think he's top tier, really, both as a guy and as a comic.
As
so I'm really looking forward to it. It should be brilliant.
It'll be a great night. And tell me, can you do any impressions yourself, seeing as we're talking about it?
I do one impression. I can do one person. It's Brian O'Donovan from RT News.
Hilarious.
Brian O'Donovan.
Is Brian with you by any chance? Could we talk to Brian for a second?
Brian is here at the moment, but the problem with Brian is that for a while he was one of RT's big guys, and now they've kind of farmed him off to the tech department. He's no longer in America, so nobody knows who I am. So it's a little unfortunate for Tig when there's only one person he can do. And now nobody really can remember the person he does. Brian O'Donovan, Tig's House. Thank you very much, y'all.
Now, I put you on the spot with that, and that's just brilliant. But everybody will be Googling him now, so you'll be grand. You'll be able to do
it. I wish I could do someone more famous, you know. Well, look, sure, that's finding them in.
You can't be good at everything, Tig. This is the thing I have to say to you.
You're already
you're an author, you're a comedian, you're a musician. Leave the impressions to Mario. He has to do something.
I will.
So listen, look, it's Saturday, the 4th of November, St. Finbar's GAA as well. It's all part of that. So listen, have a great night. It's a great, great pleasure to talk to you.
If you're ever down, to chat to you.
Yeah, if you're down this direction, you must pop in and say hello to us. And
absolutely, I'd love to.
Absolutely. We'd love to see you in here. But listen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. And the best of luck with everything that you do in the future.
Thanks so much for your time. I'll chat to you again without a doubt.
Thanks a million. Bye.